Thank you for spending some of your time with us today. We always try to make it worthwhile as we investigate, explore, and report on research, theories, and ideas. Hopefully, in the process of listening, you can learn some new things, ideas that might contribute to a greater realization. RedIceCreations.com is the main website. Go there for the latest news and headlines, stories from around the world. This is also the place for our free radio program. Then you have RedIceMembers.com, where you can sign up if you're not already a member and get full access to our archives. Listen, watch, and comment on all the radio programs, TV episodes, webcasts, video interviews, and films. You can also listen to our commentaries and download our music. Today we're talking with Charles Upton. He's a poet, author, and activist who has published numerous books on Sufism, metaphysics, and other topics. After graduating from a Catholic high school, Upton involved himself in a number of anti-war demonstrations and became acquainted with many influential figures of the Beat Generation, including Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg. Throughout the early 80s, Upton became involved in the New Age movement for several years before being introduced to the study of traditional metaphysics. His increasing interest in the traditional studies culminated in his initiation into a Sufi order near the end of the decade. In the first hour, Charles will talk about the false and subversive spiritualities and vectors of the counter-initiation. He classifies the worst of these spiritualities as examples of the counter-initiation of what he considers to be the true esoteric way. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Charles. It's good to have you with us today. Thank you for taking some time off to discuss your work with us. I'm really looking forward to this. How are you today, Charles?
I'm pretty good. I'm glad to be here. Glad to talk to you.
Excellent. This is interesting stuff. Kind of a little bit of a different perspective, but many of the themes, though, I would say, are kind of things we've talked about in different ways on the show before about. But if we were to introduce you and your work a little bit, Charles, maybe would it be a good place to begin to talk a little bit about René Guénon, or where should we begin the story if we want to kind of introduce you a little bit to our listeners?
Well, that's a good enough place to begin. As a writer, at least, I'm associated not entirely, but largely with a school of writers called the Traditionalists, who are now getting to be called the Perennialists. For some reason, and they were, you know, you could say they were founded by René Guénon, but actually he didn't know he was founding them. He wrote during the first half of the 20th century, and I think he died in 1951. He's a French metaphysician and philosopher, and his one colleague was Ananda Kumaraswamy, who's an Anglo-Indian who wrote on art theory and finally writing on metaphysics, and you know, the writers of that school include people like Sayyid Hossein Nasr and other people who have passed on, like Fritjof Schoen, Martin Lings, and Titus Burkhardt. Those are probably the major names, but there's a lot of other people also writing from that perspective. And so the title of my book is is Vectors of the Counter-Initiation, and counter-initiation is a term that is found, you know, is developed by René Guénon, and he uses it mostly in his book of The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times, although it appears other places in his work. And basically, he was much involved in occultism, every kind of occultism he could find between the world wars in France. And he came out of there saying, this is a very subversive and dangerous world. And he found in that world, elements, that he himself named the counter-initiation, people who were essentially Luciferian and attempting to undermine the revealed religions and even the esoteric organizations and centers within those religions. So that's what the term means.
Now, is there any way we can go through a little bit of some of the components or I guess the evidence for some of the things that he stumbled over? France has had a long history of being... Well, they've had a lot of esoteric literature coming out from France. Many of the Freemasonic lodges have been, of course, very prominent in France during a long time. We've had very subversive revolutions going on as well. Is all this kind of tied together, in your opinion?
Well, it is. Now, a difficulty with René Guénon is he rejected every form of occultism that he encountered, and he did so in the name of, you know, his understanding that the revealed religions, if they're understood in their depths, you know, what you call their esoteric depths, have a much truer and more complete doctrine and less destructive doctrine than the occultists. But he retained his connection with Freemasonry through most of his life. He only, as I understand, finally rejected it just at the end of his life because he was hoping, for some reason, he actually wrote for both Freemasonic and anti-Freemasonic publications. He was hoping to purify Freemasonry of what he saw the problems in it and make it into a kind of esoteric Catholicism. And I disagree with him. I think that was one of the few very wrong-headed things he did, because if he had stepped back a little bit and said, well, I've defined this thing called the counter-initiation. If he had been clear-headed about Freemasonry, he would have seen that Freemasonry itself fell under that definition pretty squarely. Freemasonry, I believe, comes from, you know, some legitimate spiritual source. It may have started as a Sufi order or something equivalent to a Sufi order within Islam. But it became deviated, particularly when it moved to the West. From it may have moved from Jerusalem into Europe, through the Templars.
Yeah.
And as soon as it did that, it became it was out of its proper context, and thereby had to ultimately become anti-Christian and anti-clerical. And that's what happened. And Guénon saw this as a degeneration of something true that could be brought back to its original purity, whereas I think it had lost any chance of that quite a while ago. And Guénon may have finally understood this at the end of his life.
All right. Now, a little bit more on your background. When did you get into his work, and maybe you can just briefly kind of summarize your path a little bit through all of this material that we're going to talk about today, if that's easy to do.
My path in some ways parallels Guénon. I was raised a Catholic, as he was in largely Catholic France. And what in my life corresponded to his period of investigating occultism was essentially the 60s counterculture, where I was not specifically interested in Western occultism, but, you know, influences from that direction and from every other direction under the sun were, you know, widespread in that movement. And so that would correspond to René Guénon's occult period. And then through reading the works of the traditionalists and finally through becoming involved in Sufism, in Islamic Sufism, this was my way of essentially purifying myself and understanding what the problems with the counterculture were. Not that the counterculture was entirely evil or entirely wrongheaded, but it had many more dark elements than we realized at the time, and it was much more infiltrated by the powers that be. You know, it was. You know, to a certain degree, not entirely, an engineered social movement, not simply a popular manifestation. So, by the same token, René Guénon, after he more or less despaired of finding what he considered to be esoteric Catholicism, or what he imagined that could be, traveled to Egypt, converted to Islam, and joined the Sufi order. So that's how he ended his life.
Now, there's so many points here that are very interesting, and I want to talk more about religion then in your view. You say that there's something real at the heart of it. Many see that many of the religions today are bunk. People see them as, you know, literative, and they see them being used in the world, I guess we could say, for different purposes, and many people don't agree with it. But what would you say to some
people? Yes, they look at religions entirely in terms of power.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a valid perspective, but it doesn't touch what the essence of any true religion is.
And how could we begin to approach that subject of the esoteric depths that you talked about? How would you explain that to someone who is not familiar with it?
Well, it's difficult to do now because the religions are all in very bad shape. I mean, and, you know, so in a certain sense, although I disagree with those who see religion as all bunk or all, you know, power politics mystified by, you know, some religious mythology, that's not my view of what they are in essence. The religions, and by which I mean Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, and perhaps a few others, and some of the primal religions of the, who have been called the primitive peoples, those which have not totally degenerated, these were all sent by God. And, somewhere at the center of them, if one can go through all of the degeneration that they manifest today, which is a hard job, and it takes God's grace, and it takes perhaps, you know, fortunate circumstances which allow you to do this. I don't know all that it takes. In other words, I'm not going to say go and do likewise, because it's not really easy.
Mm-hmm.
But if one is capable of doing that or is called to do that, you'll discover at the center of all of these religions, they are talking about the same reality. This does not mean the religions are equivalent or can be, you know, easily unified into some, you know, greater one-world religion, which I consider to be counter-initiatory in essence. And to the degree that happens, that is what has been called by some the regime of the Antichrist. But nonetheless, they are talking about the same reality, because God or absolute truth is one. You can't have more than one absolute. And the absolute must express itself in a multiple manner in this world, because this world is not the world of the absolute. This is the world of the relative. Therefore, the light of the absolute will be necessarily refracted into various colors in this world, and that's the way it should be. And that is essentially what the religions are. But, you know, if you're approaching a religion like Christianity or Islam or Hinduism, it's necessary to familiarize yourself with the scriptures that are considered to be orthodox, and also with the writings of the sages and the philosophers. And if one is, you know, if one has the call and the aptitude for that, that's the way to go. In normal times, when the religions were in better shape, the esoteric center of the religions could be transmitted to the masses in a virtual form. In other words, that they would be somehow in the presence of the esoteric or in the presence of the sacred, and would feel that. And since not everybody is an intellectual, not everybody is a philosopher, you know, that they could order their lives according to the grace of those traditions, and you know, not have to inquire further. Now, I'm afraid more and more of us have to inquire further whether or not we really have the aptitude for it, which creates many problems. But you know, those who want to know what a religion is, you know, need to read the scriptures and the writings of the great sages. In Christianity, Meister Eckhart and Dante and the Greek fathers, and in Islam, the writings of the Sufis, Ibn Arabi, Rumi, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But all was in light of the scriptures, all of the Quran or of the Bible. Because anything that sages write, and this is simply in terms of intellectual tradition, not in terms of actual spiritual influence, which is another level, another matter. But what the sages write is always in some way a commentary on the scripture. And if it departs from the scripture, then we should depart from it.
What's your stance on some of the apocryphal books or texts, like the Book of Enoch, as you say, I mean, religion has, many religions go through transformations throughout the millennia yeah. that they've existed, and a lot of things are thrown out and they're kind of refined. And if this is part of the destructive process, do you think that going back further back before it was...
Well, it's a part also of a consolidation. I mean, there was a reason that the Christian scriptures took the form that they took, and the church, as it's developed through the centuries, was based upon those scriptures. This isn't to say that there's no truth in the apocryphal scriptures. And, you know, at this point, they're available to us, and we can read them and, you know, learn things from them. But one of the difficulties, though, is that there are people particularly who consider themselves neo-Gnostics or something of that order, mm-hmm. will think that the apocryphal scriptures or the Gnostic scriptures are the real esoteric center of, you know, that has been cast out by, you know, the formalists and the legalists, and this will cast a shadow on the Orthodox scriptures, which in both Christianity and Islam are profoundly esoteric. The esotericism doesn't just, you know, appear on the fringes of things and, you know, in the Gospel of Thomas or something like that. Nonetheless, the apocryphal scriptures, you know, have some value, but I think it's important insofar as one's trying to live, you know, in the context of a particular tradition, you know, let's say we're talking about Christianity now, you know, to give precedence to the Orthodox scriptures, because there are certainly profound esoteric dimensions in the Gospels and the Epistles. And, you know, one doesn't simply have to turn to, you know, the Nag Hammadi text or anything like that to find it truly esoteric.
If we look at Roman Catholicism, I think, and maybe you would agree with this, that we can see that it's based in, to a certain degree, on previous religions. Tradition is something that just doesn't arise on day one, and then it's there. It goes through changes. It's based on other religions and previous. Now, in this process, I don't know how far back we can go, but in your view, do you see then that there is, the further back we go, there is a truer essence, and it's just slowly kind of degenerated as we go forward? Is it as simple as that, in your view?
I don't think it is as simple as that. To begin with, the traditionalists, perennialists, talk about something called the primordial tradition, which is God's first revelation to humanity, and essentially as humanity, humanity being the very revelation of God in this world on a certain level. And in earlier times, in the Golden Age, let us say, religion as we understand it now was less necessary, because it was more common for people to be able to see the reality of God. You know, we call it a mass theophanic consciousness or something like that. God was a present reality that could be seen through the natural world and you know, through whatever ritual forms they were, or simply in the human form itself. And as this vision was progressively veiled by the degeneration of time, and basically the traditionalist view, or the traditional view of history, is it is entropic. It is not progressive. You know, in terms of, you know, human openness to the divine, this is progressively eclipsed as the cycle of manifestation goes forward. And it gets to a point where restorations have to be undertaken. And so God will send prophets or avatars to found religions and, as it were, return people to the primordial tradition, but in a very particular rendition, and there being more than one of those particular renditions which are sent by God. So the religions are like partial restorations of an earlier golden age. So it isn't just a linear degeneration. You know, there are restorations, and there is the period, as I say, when we felt that we had fallen to a certain degree. Somehow things weren't right with the human race. Maybe about 500 BC, a lot of this, you know, feeling spread throughout the human race. You know, we've fallen. We're not, you know, we're not in our original relationship to God. And this is when, you know, many prophets and avatars were sent in order to restore up to a point, you know, what had been lost. But when you say religions are based upon earlier religions, I would qualify that. I would say every religion in its essence descends directly from God. I mean, Christianity came when Christ was born. Islam came when the Prophet Muhammad in his cave on Mount Hira, where he was meditating, suddenly saw the vast form of the angel Gabriel, you know, covering the entire earth and sky, and who said to the Prophet, recite. And that's when Islam began. That's when the Quran began to descend. And so all religions essentially come from eternity. They don't come from time. They're a breakthrough of eternity into time. Now, once this has happened, once the form of a particular revelation enters time, then it starts to magnetize to itself materials from other religions of the past, or from, you know, cultural material from other religions or cultures that exist contemporaneously with it. It takes what it needs. It rejects whatever is basically incompatible with it. And so it, as it were, forms itself a body in this world. But if you look at the religion only in terms of its similarities to other traditions, then you will say, well, you know, Christianity was sewn together from, you know, they took a little Judaism, and they took some Greek myth, they took something from Orphism, and they put it all together mm-hmm. in their think tanks, as it were, and came up with Christianity. And that's not the way it works. You know, the material from other religions and other places and times, as I say, is the guest at the table, but the revelation itself is the host, and it's the host who provides the nourishment. In terms of Islam, the material that drew upon from, you know, from Judaism and from many places, and later from Greek philosophy, et cetera, was all entirely Islamicized. It was given the Islamic stamp, and elements within those traditions which did not fit, and including what it took from Christianity, but elements that did not fit were rejected. And that's the way it goes. But if you only look at things in terms of time, you will think that religions, you know, are a sort of reworkings of this material that's always been here. And then you say to yourself, well, we might be able to rework it again, you know, to fit our needs, as if religions are created by human beings, which they are not. They're created by revelations from God. So
now, it's very interesting. I want to, a little bit later here, obviously, I want to get to Luciferianism, what some people call Satanism, and even if we have many of the secret societies, the alleged Illuminati and all that, where they fit into all of this picture and how they're trying to change many of these things that you know, you're talking about. But let's talk a little bit more about the restorations here first. When, in your opinion, when did the latest one of these restoration happen?
The latest one was Islam. And essentially, Islam was the last revelation that it declared itself to be such, and that seems to be pretty much the case. There have been a few, valid, you know, for example, the Sikh religion came later in a certain sense. From looking at one standpoint, it's like a syncretistic amalgam of Hinduism and Islam, but there was an element of true revelation in it which made it a true religion, you know. But that was a very late manifestation, and that was not as complete a revelation as was given to Muhammad. So in terms of complete, what you would say, world religions, Islam was the last.
Could this happen at any time, this undertaking of the restoration? Could someone come along and claim that they're the new one here? Yeah.
This is an understandable question. My belief is this cannot happen in this world age. You know, yes, there will be a restoration, or there will be a new golden age when humanity or whatever race of beings inhabits the world after humanity, however that works out. God's manifestation will return to this earth, his full manifestation, but not in terms of our particular cycle of manifestation.
And why is that? Why not?
Essentially, because the human soul has sunk to the point where it cannot receive that. You know, collectively speaking, I believe that's it. God has not just said, well, I don't like you anymore. I'm not going to send any more revelations. It's because, you know, the degeneration, as the traditionalists would say, the corruption or the degeneration of the cosmic environment itself makes us less permeable to grace, less permeable to revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can look around and see that. What has happened, basically, is people also are turning away from a sense of monotheism or a sense of a unity, whether or not it's considered in strictly theistic terms, and their view of the spiritual world is becoming once again polytheistic. I mean, many people. I mean, it becomes more plausible for many people to say there are many gods or there are spirits or this or that, and the idea of one God is becoming an opaque and more or less meaningless concept to more and more people. How could there be just one God? This universe is filled with lots and lots of different things. Why do you just say there's one God? Anybody who says there's one God only wants to impose their God on me, and I don't like that. So, you know, the more gods, the better. And this is generally the quality of our time, besides those who deny the reality of the supernatural entirely. When they turn to something beyond the material world, very often they have a polytheistic set toward it. And, you know, this is an indication of the fact that the human collective has progressively fallen away from its sense of the divine, which means the divine is less able to reach it. And the idea of apocalypse, in a certain sense, this is when the divine does reach it again, but the human collective and the cosmic environment are not open to it, and so it essentially shatters the world. The world is not open to God anymore. God comes anyway and says, here I am, and the world cannot encompass him anymore, and so the presence of God shatters the world. That's my view of what apocalypse is all about.
Is that where we are right now, or is it more things?
We're getting very close to that. I would say we are in the midst. I mean, people who take the apocalypse seriously think, when's it going to happen? You know, it's going to take 3 years or 7 years, and when is this going to start? And the signs will appear in the heavens, and this. I mean, from a certain sense, it started in 1914. And, you know, it's a large, you know, like climate change, it's a large motion it's hard to realize that human time is encompassed in a larger time, you know, so this doesn't happen overnight. But I would say that we are in the midst of it now, and we just simply don't know how long it's going to take to work itself out.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, because I wanted to try to get to this point, you know, if we get these restorations happening now and then, a new avatar, as you put it, you know, comes and updates, if you will, the message from God.
Yeah.
We have these messengers, so-called messengers, you know, arriving on the scene frequently now. And so the interesting question becomes, would you trust if someone came along and said that they were carrying this update from God? Basically, how we could make this distinction between those who actually are potentially renewing a tradition as opposed to those who are trying to destroy it or take it into another direction.
Well, those who renew it, you know, they accept it. They act within the framework of it. Now, of course, you know, this reminds one of Christ, you know, coming to Judaism being a real revelation and saying, I come not to destroy the law but fulfill it. And Christ was not accepted by the Pharisees, and so although Judaism continued on as a sort of a diminished tradition, yet still a valid one, you know, Christianity took off and essentially, you know, over 3 centuries conquered the Roman Empire. So couldn't that happen now? Couldn't Christ come back and we be the Pharisees and say, well, we don't believe, we don't believe in you because we believe in our tradition, you know, and that is a valid question.
Mm-hmm.
But, the teachers I follow and the religion of Islam and, traditionalists and also my intuition, which, you know, certainly it cannot be authoritative for anyone else, is that anybody who comes forward and says, I am the new avatar, is more likely to be the Antichrist.
Yeah.
That's the way I see things going. But, you know, I can't blame anybody for saying, well, couldn't there be another revelation? I just don't happen to agree for various reasons.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that's a tricky question here as we talk about this. It seems that in the within the apocalyptic mindset or Armageddon, whatever you want to call it, it seems like there's no way out of that situation. It's like it has to be destroyed, if you will, for something real or tangible to come thereafter. Many people have mentioned this, that whoever would come along and claim, you know, world peace and try to unify things or what have you, within the firm a Christian perspective, right, that would be ousted as the Antichrist, like, in a second, even though they might have been the real deal or genuine, you know?
Well, yeah. I don't think they would be the real deal, but that's correct.
I agree with you too. I would happen to agree with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, one thing I'd like to point out: there's more strictly canonical material on the Antichrist who's in Islam than there is in Christianity. You know, who's the Antichrist is called al-Dajjal or the Deceiver,
mm-hmm.
And it's Orthodox Islamic doctrine that at the end of this world, before you know, the dissolution of this world, the prophet Jesus will return from the dead and slay the Antichrist. And, this is their prophetic hadith from the prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. And a lot of material of that level, which is, you've got to call canonical in Islam, that talks about the Antichrist more than in Christianity.
And what is some of the, is there more, reference points to who or what it is as opposed to Christianity then, and what would that be?
There are a lot of them, and I can't recall a lot of them now. But one thing is the Antichrist is supposed to be one-eyed, blind in one eye,
mm-hmm.
which is often taken as a symbol of you know he can see the material world with his this worldly eye, but he cannot see the other world. And this is interesting because in Eastern Orthodox Christian iconography, the devil or demons are always shown as one-eyed because they're always shown in profile. So there's a parallel there. So, And a lot of the other hadith have to do with, you know, what will happen in the world during the time of the Antichrist and during the time of the Fitan, which is the Arabic word, which is pretty accurately translated as tribulation in Christian terms. And, you know, it says there will be cross-dressing will take place. There will be, towers, buildings that will reach to heaven. And then you think of the, what's the name of that building in Dubai? Burj.
Exactly, the Burj.
I mean, you just think, you know, this is entirely something that was apparently foreseen by Muhammad.
Well, that's interesting. Well, if you want to go that way, look at all the one-eyed symbolism everywhere as well. I mean,
that's true. That is becoming, and you know, this appeared in the Passion of the Christ, the movie by Mel Gibson. You know, that was full of one-eyed symbolism. It was basically attributed to the demonic, but. Unfortunately, you look at the logo or the symbol of his production company, Icon. Also one-eyed, you know. Mm-hmm. That disturbs me, you know.
Well, it's prevalent, and although it's not the symbol or logo for the Illuminati, since they used the owl, mostly, but it's still popularly associated with the eye.
You could take the symbol of the all-seeing eye at the apex of the pyramid. I mean, the single eye means two different things. I mean, in a spiritual sense, Christ said, if your eye becomes single, your whole body will be filled with light. And, you know, and then there's the third eye, in Hinduism. And all of this represents, you know, the vision of eternity or spiritual vision. And this is not a negative symbol, but when there are two eyes and one of them is blind, this becomes a very negative symbol.
Okay, interesting. Because, I mean, the Eye of Providence, as it's called, it's prominent in many of the churches around in Europe as well. Maybe not something seen in America, but if you go here to many of the Catholic churches and cathedrals and what have you, that's it's prominently featured there as well. So it can mean two things, or again, it's
yes.
a sign or a symbol telling us or letting us know that whoever is in control of organized religion today is of the destructive force, as you were. So why don't we tie in some of these things here as well?
No, because not entirely, but that is getting to be more and more the case. I mean, I hate to say, actually, I tend to follow the view of a friend of my wife's and myself, Rama P. Kumaraswamy, who is Ananda Kumaraswamy's son, and he passed away in 2006, and we knew him at the end of his life. And very interesting guy. He, as a young man, was initiated in the Brahmin caste in Hinduism. He lived most of his time in this country, but he was educated in India and initiated into the Brahmin caste. But then he realized that since he was going to live in the West, he couldn't really live as a Hindu, so he chose Catholicism. And he was choosing it just shortly before Vatican II, when he believes, and I believe, that traditional Catholicism was largely deconstructed. The sacramental order was devastated, and the church was turned over to time, you know, and rejected eternity, and hoping, you know, to become up to date and up with, you know, what was going on in the world. Many people look at this as a Masonic revolution within the church.
That's right.
In my book, there are quotations, you know, from prominent Masons who, you know, are triumphing now that Vatican II has happened. They say we've won. And Cardinal Bugnini, who was the author of the New Mass after Vatican II, is pretty clearly been proved to be a Freemason, because in a briefcase of his was found a letter from the head, I don't know of which group of Freemasons, but, you know, a prominent Freemason in Italy, you know, describing him as, you know, addressing him as brother. And many people say that John the 23rd was a Freemason and bring forward evidence. So, but what's going on now under Benedict the 16th is, I would say, purely counter-initiatory. He authored an encyclical called Caritas in Veritate, which is, you know, love and truth, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It openly calls for a one-world government. And then there's another paper that came out of one of his pontifical council on justice and peace. And this is, you know, an official Vatican, council. I mean,
mm-hmm.
These aren't people on the fringes of the church. This is right at the center of the Vatican. And this paper called for a one-world banking system as a step toward a one-world government. You know, we need a unified world financial system as a step toward a world authority with universal jurisdiction. So they're calling for one-world government. And not only are they doing that, but in the paper from the Pontifical Council, the justification for one world government was the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel was not presented as an affront to God, you know, as an attempt to create a false, you know, world religion that finally God prevented. But it was saying, well, the Tower of Babel would have been a good thing if it wasn't for all this dissension that happened. All, you know, it shows the problem with divisiveness, you know, and false, you know, false unity and divisiveness, and completely ignoring the fact that the divisiveness, the confusion of tongues, was created by God himself. That was God's will. And so this paper directly rebels against God, inverts the clear meaning of Scripture, and essentially is speaking in a Freemasonic manner, because who but the Freemasons would look at the Tower of Babel as a positive symbol?
Now, it's interesting. Now, do you think that if we examine Freemasonry, and if we assume that it's true that they have infiltrated or taken over the Vatican in one way or another, or at least very, very influential there?
Yeah, they're influential. I wouldn't say they're the only influence, but yeah, that their influence is felt in the Vatican, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Is it Luciferian in origin? Satanic difference,
well,
in your opinion?
It's not Luciferian in origin. My view of the Freemasons was, well, you know, in the First Crusade, the Templars occupied the Temple Mount, and they were given that as their headquarters. And now, of course, you have some of the most sacred buildings in Islam on the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Masjid. And my feeling is these buildings had to be maintained by somebody. You know, that there were masons and who knows, tile makers and whatever other crafts were necessary to maintain these buildings. Nowadays you think, well, you know, that they just outsourced this to the lowest bidder, right? But no, I mean, obviously these are sacred buildings, and so the people charged with maintaining them had to have a sacred function. That's the way things were looked at in those days. And so there was probably a guild of stonemasons who, within Islam, perhaps something like a Sufi order, or at least, you know, a sacred group within Islam, following the Islamic revelation, who were maintaining these buildings. And essentially, in medieval times, in both Europe and the Muslim world, and even in classical antiquity, craft guilds all had certain elements that we would consider to remind us of secret societies now, because they would have various craft techniques which they wanted to keep secret for economic purposes. You know, if you were the only person who could make this fantastic blue glass, you didn't want anybody else to find out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And so at the same time, the craft techniques of the various guilds tended to be interpreted allegorically and symbolically. I'm living in Kentucky now, in the state of Kentucky in the United States, and at a local college, we saw, my wife and I, a production of the Wakefield Cycle, which is some medieval mystery plays that were put on by the various craft guilds. And I was looking at this and said, these are symbolic allegories. For example, the coopers, you know, those who made barrels, you know, the Cooper's Guild,
mm-hmm.
Their play had to do with the creation of the universe, because they viewed the making of a barrel, you know, the making of something that could contain and protect, you know, a valuable content. They looked at it in terms of the creation of the universe. You know, that was, they said, our craft is derived from God's creative act of creating everything, and you know, it's an allegory of creation. And so this is very common in craft guilds. In fact, I have a tortoiseshell comb that was made by a guild of traditional Muslim comb makers in North Africa. And their patron, and of course, every guild would have a patron saint, or a patron in Islam, a patron prophet. And their patron prophet was the prophet Seth, you know, who was Adam's second son,
mm-hmm.
after Abel was murdered, or actually third son. And so I go to Ibn al-Arabi, who's the greatest Sufi writer and metaphysician, who wrote a book called the Fusus al-Hikam, The Bezels of Wisdom, you know, the bezel being a setting for a jewel. And I looked up, and each chapter is on a different prophet. So I looked at the prophet Seth, And said, well, Seth represents the function that draws the original profusion of creation into lines of order. And I said, well, that's, you know, that they were seeing the comb as an allegory of this function. You know, the original right. profusion of your hair when you wake up in the morning is drawn into lines of order by a comb. Yeah. So this is the way people would look at the allegorical meaning of a particular craft. And so, undoubtedly, the people who were maintaining some of the most sacred buildings in Islam would have an allegorical and esoteric interpretation of their craft techniques. And it's entirely possible that these people, either some of the craftsmen themselves or their techniques, which had to be taught, you know, these couldn't, you know, just be written down and sent to
right,
Europe. They
right.
had to be taught to European craftsmen, either in the Holy Land or in Europe. You know, these people may be who the Masons, you know, who ultimately became the Masons. Unfortunately, a sacred craft guild or a Sufi order or something of that nature would only be legitimate within Islam. This is one of the marks of the counter-initiation is syncretism, where you illegitimately cross religious boundaries. So when these people went to the West, or at least, you know, their techniques were taught in the West, and their lore passed to the West, you would have an influence operating within Western Masonic guilds, which was not entirely Christian, and it was heterogeneous, and ultimately it became anti-Christian and it became counter-initiatory because it had departed from its parent revelation. This is one thing that produces the counter-initiation. You have an esoteric group which is intrinsic to a particular revelation, departs from it, and goes somewhere else or thinks that they can operate on their own without that revelation, and then they become counter-initiatory. There's so much occultism you see in the West of, you know, people who had an esoteric understanding of the Christian revelation and finally said, well, since the exoteric authorities do not understand us, then why do we need them? And we will go, you know, and do it on our own. I mean, this is a perennial temptation to Sufis. You know, is to say, you know, Sufism is a religion unto itself. As soon as it does that, whatever Sufi group or order does that has become counter-initiatory. So, you know, so much Western occultism comes from this tendency. And it's difficult because, you know, when a religion shrinks and when it has less, a revelation has less room within it for, you know, a deep understanding of its own doctrine, it will tend to drive people with a more esoteric understanding out. But if it succeeds in doing that, it loses, you know, a dimension of depth, and the people who are driven out become counter-initiatory. You know, so one of the actually asceticisms required of esoterics within a particular revelation is to stay within the revelation, even if they're not understood. Perhaps it's good for them not to be understood. You know, it will humble them in the right way if they know how to take it.
Now, you argue that there is a tradition and a culture within all over the place, of course, but we talk about the Western world for the moment, and this is familiar to the people who live here. And even though we might not agree with it, they have come to eventually represent an order, I guess, a structure within society. Even if we go back far enough, I would argue that it's been imposed. But nonetheless, we've lived where now it's here, and so
it was imposed in some cases. But also, paganism was extremely tired. Christianity could not have conquered the Roman Empire unless it had filled a real need. But in particular instances, in some cases it was imposed. I mean, you know, King Clovis, through the influence of his wife, converted to Christianity and told all the Franks, now you're Christians whether you like it or not. This did happen. On the other hand, in the British Isles, Patrick and Columba and people like that were able to convert the British Isles without, you know, without war and without oppression. And many of the Druids were actually waiting for the new revelation because they had had visions that something new had occurred and were waiting, as it were, for the Christian missionaries to tell them about Christ. And they were some, you know, Druids opposed the Christian missionaries, certainly, but others were very open. So that it's, you know, it's complex.
It is complex. It's also, and that's why I think that this there is a resonance between ancient older traditions and whatever the new incoming was. They had to also tweak it, if you will, slightly to make it fit into the territory or region that we're moving in. But certainly there have been bloodshed.
This is true. Yeah. And you know, the question is, were the pagan, you know, holidays and the pagan practices fully Christianized? You know, in some cases they really did become Christian. In other cases it was imperfect.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have had, as Fritjof Schuon would say, if it had been perfect, you wouldn't have had the Renaissance, which was essentially the revenge of paganism on Christianity. And certainly you wouldn't have had Hitler.
Now, wait a minute, the Renaissance there, let's talk about that. Now, is your view, is that scene, what's your take on that? Is that something that was part of the subversive or the counter?
Well, I mean, it represented, at its best, a reconstitution of, you know, a more or less viable worldview on a lower level than the medieval. Because, you know, the medieval synthesis broke up, and Renaissance picked up the pieces and made a civilization which was no longer self-contained, but had to expand. You know, had to expand economically, had to expand in terms of exploration.
In order to survive, or for what reason?
Well, yes, in order to survive, because the sense of eternity was being lost. Now, of course, what you had is a Renaissance and a rediscovery of a lot of, you know, the esotericism and the spiritual meaning and writings of paganism and Kabbalah, you know. And so these had some interesting influences. There was, within the Renaissance, a kind of an esoteric renewal, but it could never be fully embraced by the Church. And, you know, which is both because it was heterodox in Christian terms in many ways, although Dante could embrace it. Dante could embrace almost everything. You know, Dante shows how when Christianity was strong, it could take the best of paganism and truly Christianize it. But by the time the Renaissance had come along, that was no longer possible because the Church had shrunk to a point where it was not as open to its own esoteric dimension as you can see Dante was. So the material that came from paganism tended to feed an extra-Christian and finally anti-Christian occultism.
All right. Well, very interesting. There's much more to discuss here. We're talking about the book Vectors of the Counter-Initiation. Let's give out the websites a little bit like this. We're going to take a break here now in a few minutes. And we want to let people know where they can go to read more about your work and, of course, this latest book. Is it simply sophiaperennis.com that people should go to, Charles?
Yeah, www.sophiaperennis.com. Sophia Perennis, one word. And actually, you can in the United States, this can be found on Amazon.com. In the UK, on Amazon.co.uk. And also in this country, Barnes & Noble. Some of my books are featured on my website, not all of them.
Most of your titles are available through Amazon, that's what you're saying?
Yeah, all of them are available.
All right, and you span all across the board, of course. This is not restricted to what we've been talking about here in the first hour. It goes into a lot of different aspects, and we'll see if we get a chance to talk about some more of that, of course, in the second hour. But we'll take a short break here. Again, the website, sophiaperennis.com. We're going to have this up linked up on redicecreations.com, so you can click into the publisher there and read more, and also the links to the books here. So stay with us, Charles. We'll be right back with more. In the second hour, we'll continue on counter-initiations and discuss revolutionary movements, the New Age religion, technological advances, psychedelics, the 1960s, alien disclosure, and the Green Movement. Upton explains how these have been used as an up-to-date mind control operation. Then we'll talk about deviated esotericism and explore the various esoteric and political groups which are part of the counter-initiation. From redicemembers.com, you can stream and download the entire program, the 2 hours with Charles Upton, or any of our previous programs. Comment on the show, subscribe to our RSS feeds, or find related programs. We have a recurring subscription option, or subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years. It's only €5 per month, and of course, when you sign up, you'll get instant access. We are listener-supported, so if you like what we do and want to hear more, consider signing up for a membership. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Santos Bonacci on syncretism, astrotheology, and the holy science, and a great counter-argument to some of the aspects we've discussed today here with Charles Upton. After this, Joseph Atwill with Fritz Heed and Niola Sparkis, and then Larkin Rose. And in between, Doc Miss Radio 314 with Mark Devlin, and upcoming Simon G. Powell on the psilocybin solution. Following this, on Red Ice Radio, we have Katie Diolos, Douglas Dietrich, Sterling Seagrave, Barbara Oakley, Paul Hellier, and Mark Gaffney. Some interesting programs coming up. Don't miss it. Tune in when it pleases you and when you have the time. Stream or download directly from the website or subscribe to our RSS feeds to get the program into your iTunes or your podcast app on your Android or iPhone or iPad. Couldn't be simpler. You'll find all the instructions in our FAQ on redicemembers.com. More coming up now with Charles Upton. Stay with us.